the fraction gratings, which we'll use for a demo in a little while, but it takes a few minutes to hand them out, so I asked them to do that now. I will want the diffraction gratings back at the end of class, just so you know. You may have noticed we're moving quite fast. This class is really hard to get the balance right. At this point in the semester, I'm always absolutely certain I spent way too much time on electromagnetism, but whenever I look at electromagnetism and think about what I cut out or speed up, I tend to come away bamboozled and don't have a good solution, so sorry about that. Probably not going to be able to do as much with nuclear physics as I feel like I should do with you guys, so there may be a little hole there, but we'll talk about that at the end of the term in terms of things that you almost certainly would need for MCATs if that's what you're doing, or actually for what you're doing, nuclear physics is important. So I'll at least point out some things that we don't have a chance to cover. Last class is in a week, actually, so counting this one, it's only three. Final exam is May 6th. It'll be at 7:15 at night. I'll give you 3 hours to do it. It will be not quite as long as two times your normal test. So you have more than twice the time, and I try to make it a little shorter than two full term exams. It's long, it's cumulative. So that'll be fun. It'll be in Hubble, so you'll have room to spread out. Okay? And pretty much the rest of the drill is the same. Any questions on that? I will set up a Q&A session, you know, sometime a day or two before that. Yeah.
Is there any like extra weighting towards the stuff that we have to be tested on before?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Is there extra weighting toward the stuff that you haven't been tested for? There will be a little, but it won't be extreme, partly because I know it's fast and partly because, in a sense, we won't have done all that much, but it'll be some... I'll figure out what it is, but it'll be a little bit weighted toward the new stuff. Anything else? Yes?
Are you allowing us, like, a little bit...
You certainly can do, count on being able to do one page of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper. In years past, I might have given a full sheet, but I actually don't want you to emphasize the writing on the sheet so much. That's not the way to study for it, so I'm beginning to think the one half a page is a better way to go, or the one side. Anything else? Besides, you're young and your eyes are still good, so you can write really small. I'll bring a tootsie roll for the person who has the smallest writing on there. Okay, anything else? All right, so tell me three reasons why you should believe that light is a wave. Say again? It can travel through a vacuum. Can you think of another wave that can travel through a vacuum?
No.
That is a phenomenal property of light. It wouldn't be what I would think of as a compelling reason to believe it is a wave in and of itself. In fact, that's the thing that makes it weird for a wave. It's the fact it's the only one that can go through a vacuum that I know of. Yeah?
It exists in fraction patterns.
I just lied, by the way, but we'll get there. Diffraction, okay. So light is diffractive. Other waves, like water waves, we saw, are diffractive as well. Anything else? Diffraction is due to interference. Waves exhibit interference. Right? Anything else? What did dude Maxwell tell us about? He gave us those equations, and I didn't extract it for you, but from those you can find that E and B actually satisfy wave equations. And those wave equations are mathematically the same for E or B individually as what you would get if you were looking at a wave on a screen. So that actually defines what you mean in a sense when you talk about a wave. Refraction happens with waves. So the point of this is there's no question at all that light is a wave of phenomena. Okay? And you should believe that. Okay? I want you to believe light is a wave.
Amen, brother.
That's what I want to hear. Alright, so let's... I'm telling you, it's a wave, okay? Lots of reasons to believe. The theory is very clear. Mathematics is well understood. Interference, diffraction, refraction. All of these are things that are characteristics of waves. We have all sorts of experiments that optics works because light is a wave. So it is a wave, okay? And then it does, it's strange for a wave because it travels through a vacuum, okay? But that's well understood in the context of Maxwell because you have this weird E inducing B induces E, and it doesn't actually need a medium. Although this was not at all obvious when Maxwell did his thing. People thought that E and B, because there are waves, because light is a wave, that it has to be a wave in something. Like water is a wave, you know, you have waves on water, you have waves in strings. You have sound waves in air, so what is it for light? And so people realize we don't see anything. So there must be something there, but because it's ethereal, we'll call it the ether. And so there was this idea that light was a wave phenomenon traveling in a substance called ether that really you didn't feel very easily, very, very well. But if their universe were filled with this ether, then you should be able to detect your motion through the ether by looking at... If I throw a rock in a pond and I look at the water wave propagate, it has a certain speed. If I look at the water wave propagate and I'm running beside it, relative to me, it's not moving anymore. Okay? So if the wave is traveling in some absolute material, then we should be able to detect our motion by seeing the velocity of light be different in different directions. And people did careful experiments about this around the turn of the century and found that, in fact, the speed of light is the same in all directions, which is a very bizarre thing. And it is that very fact that is one of the two postulates that underlies the theory of special relativity, which Einstein published in 1905. And I'm afraid one of the things that's going to get cut in this class, which I'm really sad about because it's very cool, is that if you make up this crazy idea that no matter how I move, if I look at light, it has the same speed, and you pursue that, it ends up completely overthrowing your entire worldview of space and time itself. Time and space are no longer absolute quantities. They actually depend on your motion in the universe. So it's a very bizarre thing. Unfortunately, we're probably not going to be able to do it, but why I'm babbling on about it right now is that it turns out there is no ether, and then in fact light does travel through a vacuum, and it works because you have this weird phenomenon of an E inducing a B, which induces an E, and that can happen in a vacuum. You don't actually have to have a piece of string moving and yanking up the piece beside it, which is sort of how a mechanical wave works. So, no question, though, that light is clearly a wave phenomenon. And, you know, just because Maxwell was in the 1800s, doesn't mean he was stupid. People then were very, very smart. They understood waves very well. Basic physics was basic physics for the most part back then. What we didn't have was quantum mechanics and relativity yet. And that's sort of the start for where I am. People understood light very, very well. They understood waves very well, and the implications were pretty clear. So you might say, if I understand light so well from Maxwell, maybe I ought to be able to calculate something very simple. And so the simplest thing one of the simple things people tried to calculate was simply, what is the spectrum of light? That is, how does the color, frequency, and intensity of light vary when I look at the glow of something as I heat it up? And there's a reason why I have to look at the glow of something in order to understand. If I have something that I am looking at by shining a light on it, then whatever I see is dictated in part by what it is I'm shining it on, okay? But it's also dictated in part by the source of the light itself. So what I observe is not really fundamentally characteristic of what I'm staring at, the material. So it becomes more complicated. The light I observe is some sort of convolution of the emission and the reflection. Okay? Complicated. So the way to try to simplify things is to say, suppose I take something and I encase it in something that is completely black. Okay? So there is no reflected light whatsoever. And then I look at that thing. And look is sort of a strange word here, but I look at that thing in pitch blackness, and I ask, what do I see? And you may think, well, you see nothing, you're in pitch black. That's not true. You take a fireplace poker and you put it in a closet. Hopefully you've removed the coats first. But if you have a hot fireplace poker and you go in a closet, it sure looks like something, right? It's glowing, red or whatever. It turns out that everything glows because everything is at equilibrium with the environment around you. If something is hot, you feel it. That's infrared radiation coming up. You may not see it with your eyes, but it's glowing. So then the question is, can you take something as simple as a substance and ask, can I understand the spectrum of light that it emits on its own, its glow, if you will? And because you're eliminating all of the reflected light, we call that stuff black body radiation. And you can imagine taking something and putting it in sort of a closed shell and maybe making a pinhole. With just the pinhole, you don't have light going in and bouncing off of it, but I can look at the light coming out of the cavity. Okay? So whatever's going on in the cavity, this glow is at equilibrium in the cavity, and you look at whatever light's coming out. So that's sort of how you would do this. And so then the question is, can I understand what the intensity of light is as a function of the frequency, and how does that change with temperature? So if you do that experiment and you look at things, what you find is that if you plot the light intensity here as a function of the wavelength, all right, so longer wavelength is over here, so red light is over this way, blue light is over that way toward the left, and as I heat the object up, what you find is that the peak moves from red toward the blue. The intensity of the light sort of moves from red to blue. And it's low, and there's a peak, and then it's low again. But it has a very characteristic shape, which is called black body radiation shape. You've seen this. If you take a fireplace poker, it's black. You don't see anything. Why? Because the peak is way over here. Now you put it in a fire. You heat it up. it glows a deep red, and then that red becomes a brighter red, and then it sort of begins to get white, and it's hottest, it sort of looks blue, right? So that's the same thing on oven elements and stuff if you have an old-fashioned element. So this is not that crazy to you, okay? And you've seen it a lot. When you turn on a heating element and the current is going through, it's depositing a lot of energy, it's getting hot, you see the glow go from a deep red up to a much brighter red as you turn it up. So this should be something simple to calculate. In principle, if we really understand the nature of light and how light interacts with matter itself. So people try. And these are not dumb people. They have really good models to do this. But when they did, what they found was classical theory could not duplicate the curve that was very clearly seen in experiments at all. It failed miserably. Okay? And there was pretty broad agreement that the theoretical approach, insofar as it was for classical physics, seemed right. And the experiments were unassailable and duplicated everywhere, so easily replicable. So there's a real problem here. So along came this guy, and he was able to extract the mathematical formula, he was able to derive it, that fit these curves exactly. And when he did so, he made an absolutely crazy assumption. And that assumption was a core piece of the mathematics that he derived, which did this. What he assumed was that light comes in little packets. It's like particles. And that these packets have an energy, each packet has an energy that is proportional to the frequency of the light. The constant of proportionality is this thing called H. It's Planck's constant. Planck for the guy who came up with this crazy idea. This tells you that, for example, if you look at the particles within the light, blue light, which is higher frequency, has more energy than red light. X-rays, which are higher frequency, have more energy than radio waves. Okay, so that's what this says. You ever seen a wave that's a particle? I mean, that doesn't even make any sense. I don't know how to tell you how stupid this idea is. Because we know light's a wave. There's no question light is a wave, so what are you talking about that you have it as a particle? So the general feeling at the time was that this guy Planck clearly came up with the right equation because it fit the data at different frequencies and at different temperatures perfectly. So he got the right equation. We don't know how he got the right equation, because clearly he's nuts. What he assumed to get the right equation makes no sense. There must be another way. Now we know the answer. Let's try to figure out how to get it. And nobody could get it. Okay? So it was a bit of a mess. And then came this guy Einstein. There was something else that people didn't understand. See, it was sort of funny. If you had asked somebody, in fact, I forget who it was, let me think for just a moment. It may have been Planck. I've actually forgotten who it was. But a very famous physicist was told when he was, like, in college, you know, what should I do? You know, don't do physics. We know it all. Go be a musician or something, because we already know all the physics. And he's basically told this is a waste of your time. There were only a few puzzles that people really had at the time. Black body radiation being one of them. Here's another one that we have, which is called the photoelectric effect. Basically, if you shine light on a heavy metal or a metal of some form, it will emit electrons. And it turns out that there's funny characteristics of this. First of all, no matter how intense the light is, if you're below a certain frequency, these electrons won't come out. That completely disagrees with what you would do if you were looking at this thing classically. Classically, if an electron is able to absorb light energy, and that light energy is, you know, only has so much energy, all that electron has to do is sit there and absorb it longer and longer, and eventually has enough energy to sort of make it out of the metal. So classically, there's no threshold of the sort that people talk about. And it doesn't matter how intense the light is if it's below a certain frequency, which is another thing. If the electron's just sitting there collecting light, collecting the energy before it leaves the metal, if I make that light more intense, that's more energy per square meter per unit time. It should take less time for that electron to jump out. And there appears to be no dependence on that in terms of the energy of these electrons. So there's some weirdness to understanding exactly how light ejects these electrons out. And Albert Einstein, in 1905, came up with a model that, again, explained the data perfectly. But in order for him to do it, his model assumed light came in little packets, where the energy was proportional to the frequency. And if you go and you look at the measurements and you extract that constant of proportionality, lo and behold, you get the same constant of proportionality that you need to satisfy Planck's measure. I don't know why, but this always reminds me of that horrible day in September of 2001, where I got a call from my then wife, who says, a plane just hit the World Trade Center. And I'm like, oh, wow. You know, I assumed it was like a Piper Cub and the idiot who had come in. And she said, no, they were showing pictures that looked like a big plane. And I thought, really? And while she was on the phone, the second plane. And it was just an earth-shattering shift in perspective. You had a horrible accident. And immediately when the second plane hit, you knew that it was no accident, that there was something going on, right? So, clearly a very imperfect analogy in many ways, but Planck was crazy. But now you've got some other phenomenon that you explain perfectly with exactly the same picture. So suddenly you could no longer assume Planck was crazy. You basically were stuck with the fact that light was a particle. And this is a wonderful example, in my mind, of a limitation of human imagination, if you will, or our ability to see things. Because conceptually, particles and waves are really very different things to us. So we really can't think of them as being the same thing. But nature doesn't appear to have so many hang-ups like that. So, for whatever reason, it appears light has both wave and particulate characteristics, and which view you use really depends on what question you have. If you're doing optics, generally, you think of it as a wave. It depends on the type of optics you're doing. But, so, we're sort of stuck with this. Light is both a wave and a particle, and this was sort of a new thing. Just as an aside, in 1905, Einstein published 4 papers. This was one paper, and one can easily make the case that this launched quantum mechanics, because it is sort of this wave particle duality that is at the core of quantum mechanics. One of his other papers was, I mentioned a moment ago, was looking at the nature of life. He actually called it on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. And he was using, he invented relativity, and he overthrew our entire view of space and time when he did that. But the story is better when I've convinced you of that. I'm not taking the time to do so. Sorry about that. His other paper was, again, an extension of relativity, and it was the E equals mc squared paper, which basically launched the atomic age. It was the mass-energy equivalence. And then the fourth paper he did that very year was to explain Brownian motion. Do you know what Brownian motion is? If you take a microscope and you look at dust and oil, you'll find that the dust is jiggling around. And you think, who cares? But if you look at the jiggle, okay, physicists are weird because they like, you know, they look at things in detail. I mean, don't tell me taxonomists and biology aren't weird. Yeah? So they're looking and trying to understand how this motion, where it comes from, and actually it turns out people weren't understanding it. Einstein explained it. And he explained it as the statistical motion you would get if this dust particle was getting bashed by little things that were moving thermally called atoms. Atoms had been around in terms of thought for a long time. But this was the first direct evidence for it. You could actually see it, and you could measure it, and you could understand its motion precisely due to this bashing around due to the atom. I mean, that's pretty cool. And that was his most boring paper that year. His Nobel Prize didn't come for relativity, which I can't tell you how amazing that is because we haven't done relativity, but it came for the photoelectric effect, primarily, which is, like I say, launched quantum mechanics. Anyway, so Einstein was an amazing guy. So a little bit more on the photoelectric effect. So the idea is you shine light on a metal, and if you have a reverse charge across here, that is, I put a potential difference across here such that if I eject an electron, it gets reversed here in direction. Okay? And if I set the energy, the potential here, just right, then I take a maximum kinetic energy for the electrons here, and they won't quite make it across. And if I reduce the potential just a little bit, as soon as that potential is equal to the kinetic energy of this electron, I get current. Okay? So this is a way of measuring the maximum kinetic energy of the electrons that are ejected by this, by the light hitting this metal. So you can measure the kinetic energy of the electron as a function of the frequency of the light. You can do it as a function of intensity too. And what they found, and this doesn't work classically at all, is that there's a frequency below which it doesn't matter how intense the light is. You get no electrons at all. But at a certain frequency, you begin to get electrons, and as you go up in frequency, the electrons come off with more and more energy. And the way that you understand it is that you have an electron that's bound in the metal by a certain amount of energy. That binding is what we call the work function in this, in the photoelectric effect lingo. And you then hit it with a particle of light that has an energy, H nu. When that particle is absorbed, you get an energy difference here, which is the kinetic energy of the electron. So when the frequency is too low, you don't have enough energy here to be larger than the work function, and you can't kick any of the electrons out. And then as the frequency goes up, you can kick them out, and also as you begin to have more and more energy as you go up in frequency, because the packet that's incoming has more energy. So that's the picture that Einstein came with. It's really pretty simple, except it contains this absolutely whack job idea that Planck had earlier. And I don't actually know, I mean, presumably Einstein knew about Planck's, but he had to know about Planck's work. And he sort of used that idea here, and it worked. You okay with that? Okay, so there was another effect called the Compton effect, which also required light to have a particulate nature, but we have this weird state where very clearly light is a wave, and very clearly light is a particle. Okay? And we just have to deal with it, I guess, is the only way to say it. Like I say, nature doesn't appear to have an abhorrence of this combination that we seem to have. All right. So then it gets weirder. I'm skipping ahead a few years. I'll come back a little bit. But the next really bizarre step in the development of quantum mechanics came when this guy, Louis Victor Pierre Raymond, 7th Duke de Broglie. I'd like to have a name like that. Mid-20s, so 1905 to mid-20s is a bit of a step. For his PhD thesis, he made a very bizarre hypothesis, which only in retrospect doesn't seem as bizarre as it probably did at the time. But it was really as simple as, well, if a wave like light can be a particle, maybe particles can be waves. That's sort of the essence of it, okay? Now, you can motivate it, which I'm not going to drag you through, but you can take a little bit of stuff that comes out of relativity, which was known at the time, and you can take E equals H nu, which we get from this particulate nature of light, and you can sort of extract what you might expect for how the wavelength and the momentum might depend on each other. And he basically said, let me assume that's true for particles. So it's a really weird idea. Most really weird ideas in PhD theses in physics are not true. This one turned out to be true. So what he said was, if I have a particle, I'm going to assume it has wave-like characteristics. You're not going to need to extract where this came from or probably even feel warm and fuzzy about it. But what he said was there's a relationship between the wavelength of the particle and its momentum that is given by this. And in a funny way, this is actually sort of consistent with this weird picture that Planck and Einstein came up with. So it is something of an extension to that. But he's saying even a particle with mass can have a wavelength. So, I'm a particle. I have a wavelength. Which means, in principle, I should diffract when I go through the doorway. Just to give you a sense of how weird this is. Okay? I should interfere, diffract, all these things if I'm a wave. It turns out this H is a really tiny number. So I have a wavelength in this picture. Baseball has a wavelength in this picture. But my wavelength is really tiny, which means when I go through a doorway, it's a huge opening, and the diffraction maximum is very narrow. That is, you don't notice it like you do with light through a thin opening. Okay? So the trick is H is so small that when you take things that are going in normal speeds and normal sizes in the realm of the reality that we live in, you don't notice the wave-like characteristics of it. It's not relevant for us, okay? But that doesn't mean you can't construct an experiment where you see it. So we can calculate, for example, the wavelength of a baseball that's traveling, you know, a good fastball, 92 miles per hour or so. It has momentum, it has a mass, you can calculate the wavelength, and what you find is it's 1 times 10 to the minus 34 meters. That's a pretty short wavelength. That's why you don't notice, okay? But let's take an electron, give it 1 EV, okay? And I'll use a classical picture here to get its momentum. and I calculate its wavelength, and I get 1.3 micron. And that's starting to get in the realm of things you can actually look at and measure. So, in fact, you can take electrons and you can put them through substances where you have, say, atoms, and think of the atoms as doorways, and you can see diffraction of electrons or neutrons or whatever. You may know it as crystallography, where you actually look at that diffraction pattern, and from that you can infer the shape of the doorway, if you will. So this is very much something we can do. And so, to take me back for a moment to connect with the last lecture, one of the things that I hope you picked up, although I know we were going very fast, was that if I have an object and I'm trying to image it, to image that object, I have to be able to optically separate the view of something on one side of the object from something on the other side of the object. I have to resolve them. Okay? But if I think of these as two different sources of light, that light can interfere. You can think of this as a single slit. And so I'll have diffraction, or another way to think about it is if I have an opening to my instrument, the light will diffract as it goes through, and the closer together things are, the harder it is for me to tell the difference between them in the image. Okay? If the wavelength is bigger, diffraction becomes a big deal when the wavelength is on the order of the size of the slit or the separation of the two objects. Okay? So if I have a small opening to my microscope, there's, how do I say this right? If you think of trying to image things, you need to image them with objects that are smaller than that object itself. To get a shadow, you need to have the wavelength be smaller than the object. If the wavelength is on the order of the object, you can't measure it at all. You get diffraction. So what that means is that if you're trying to use a microscope to look at smaller and smaller things, you have a limit you cannot beat, and it's the diffraction limit. You can't really go smaller than the size of the wavelength you're using to image it. So a way to beat that is you can use a high-energy beam of electrons. If I go to high energy, I go to high momentum. That reduces the size of the wavelength, and I can control it. So if you use the wave-like characteristic of the electrons, you can actually image things that are vastly smaller than the limit that you have with optical lenses, which is why when you go really tiny, you use electron microscopes. You okay with that? All right, so it seems to me it's getting hot here. I'm seeing the cycle between. See if the screen doesn't blow up there. Okay, so. So, when did Brueghel? Quantum mechanics really gets launched because he says that particles have wave-like characteristics. The moment you say particles have wave-like characteristics, you now have to rework all the mechanics that you use to understand particles in terms of waves. And that is what quantum mechanics really is. That's what hardcore modern quantum mechanics is. And we will come back to that. What I'd like to do is, and there's a reason why I went out of order here, is that I want to go back about 8 years or so to around 1912-ish. There's this guy named Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr was trying to understand atomic spectra. Okay? So I would like you to appreciate a little bit what I mean when I say that. So you have a handed diffraction grating to you, and you can look at diffraction enough to know you can. It has a lot of little rulings on it. And what that will do is it will act as a sort of super prism for you. Now, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to turn on a white light, okay? And what you want to do is to take this diffraction grating and literally put it up to your eye all the way, and you want to turn it one way or the other such that what you will see is sort of spectra, a rainbow off to each side. Are you seeing it? You want to see it going left and right. If you see something going up and down, turn your thing 90 degrees. Alright. One thing you should note is that you see a smooth rainbow from red to purple. Right? What does that mean? What do you think that means? Huh? Right. It means that when I heat up this element, I am generating light of all different frequencies. Okay? And maybe that should make sense, because all I'm really doing is I'm taking a current and I'm shoving it through this resistor, and I have it banging all sorts of things. So it excites light in all sorts of different frequencies. Okay, so now what I want to do is I'm going to show you a gas, and we pass a current through the gas. This current will strip electrons off the gas that will then cascade back down, and you will see something rather different. This one is mercury. What do you see when you look at mercury? Actually, I have to close these. Tell me what you see. Alright, what I see to each side, and you can think of each side as being just mirror image, if you will. I see different, we call them orders, and when you do your stuff on gratings, you'll see that there are different orders. But if you just look as you go to one side, say the right side, I see a purple line, a green line, a yellow line, and a small red line. That's all I see. This is spectrum analyzing the light. So what it's saying is that this atom is only emitting those discrete frequencies. Okay? And it turns out it doesn't matter where you get your mercury or where you're doing this. Those are the frequencies mercury will show you. If we do neon... now you see a different set of frequencies. These are fingerprints for these particular atoms, okay? Very particular frequency fingerprints. That's krypton. That's hydrogen. Hydrogen's a pretty simple beast. It's a proton and one electron. And nature's telling us something here, right? Doesn't matter where you find the hydrogen, if you spectrum analyze it, it has a very particular set of frequencies that it emits. And they're very well mapped out. And at the time Bohr came around, they were very, very well known. I think I have one more. Helium. Anyway. You get the idea. Alright, watch out. Wrong one.
Wrong one.
Okay. So these are the atomic spectrum. They're fingerprints for the specific atoms. And if you want to try to understand how light and matter interact, this is your laboratory. This is what you have to understand. Okay. So the problem is, classically, if you do this, who's... Okay, so if you do this classically, and you actually did a problem in workshop where if you calculate, if you have an electron in an atom and you think the force that's holding it is electromagnetism, it's going to move around the circle or something, and it's going to lose energy because when things accelerate, they radiate, which is not something we really talked much about, but that's a fact. And so this thing... Atoms should not be stable classically. So Niels Bohr came up with again sort of a crazy model. He came up with a crazy model because he was actually trying to understand these discrete spectra, which he couldn't understand classically, so he sort of threw in something new. Okay? This is called a semi-classical model. It's not quantum mechanical in the sense that it contains some elements of quantum mechanics, but in this model, he thinks of the electron as just a particle. Okay? Not as a wave. He doesn't invoke that here. De Broglie hasn't come up with his PhD thesis. De Broglie is probably in the first grade or second grade at this point. Anyway, so what is the model? You might say this is not actually our model of the atom now, but I'm actually going to go through it a little bit because it's very intuitive and it gives you a lot of the basic characteristics of actual real atoms. So it's a good thing to have at your fingertips. So in the Bohr model, he assumes that the electron is a point-like particle, has a charge, you know, minus one. There's a force between the electron and the nucleus, which is just electrostatic in nature. Okay? And he says that electrons move in circles. Why? Because I know how to describe a circle, right? I know what it means. It means the force toward the center is mv squared over r. So that's what he assumes. And then he assumed something sort of wacky. He said that the electron moves in a circle and that those circles are stable. That directly contradicts classical physics because if the electron is moving in a circle, it ought to be radiating away its energy and it should not be stable. So here is where he ad hoc puts in what we call quantum mechanics, in a sense, but he doesn't know why. He just knows he needs it in order to have these discrete spectra. So that's his picture. Turns out that if in this classical picture, you can derive and extract a lot of things, okay? Because basically you say, well, have a circle, there's a force toward the center, it's a circle. So that force is mv squared over r. I know what the force is, it's electrostatic. So that goes as k times e squared over r squared. Alright? So I have the central traction toward the center, and the centripetal force has to be this. Alright? This model is only for a single electron atom. So think of it as hydrogen as the simplest thing, but if I have a more complicated atom, like helium or lithium or iron, in this model you can still do it, except you multiply one of these E's by Z, because the center, the nucleus has, you know, Z protons. So you can, this changes if you go to an atom that has more protons. Anyway, so this is very straightforward, I hope you'll agree. And then he adds in the discreteness. He puts in a condition. The condition he puts in is he says that the circumference that we have, well, what he said was that the momenta is fixed. That is, the momentum times the radius is equal to some number times a constant h-bar, h-bar being Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. In Bohr's day, I have no idea how he got that. He sort of just pulled it out of thin air. He probably thought about it a bit more, but he didn't think of electrons as waves. If you think of electrons as waves, it turns out this makes complete sense. Because what you want is, if you think of the electron as a wave that in principle is moving at a certain radius, the stable wave will be the one where you have a standing wave. That is, as you go around one full circumference, you want it to be an integral number of wavelengths, so that in a sense, as it goes around, it constructively interferes with itself. If you think of it as a wave, and that wave has to go around the circle, if you imagine making a circle out of lengths of straw, drinking straws, okay? So you have a fixed number. Then if I have to have only circles that I can make with fixed drinking straws, then I'm only going to have circles of certain radii that work. One radius will be where I bend the whole straw around. Another radius that works will be the one where I can put 2 straws together and bend them around. Another one will be I have 3 straws, okay? Think of each straw as one wavelength for this electron. So if you think of the electron as a wave, it turns out that there's reason to believe that you might have discrete radii that actually work. And you can even calculate it. 2 pi r is the length that you have to go, and you want that to be equal to an integer number of wavelengths. Pull the 2 pi down, you get h bar, okay? And you actually end up getting exactly the relationship that Bohr used. So oddly enough, when de Broglie came around and claimed that electrons might be waves, he also sort of motivated this discrete aspect of the Bohr model. When you talk about things being discrete, we call it quantized. So this is the quantization condition in the Bohr model that gets motivated when you begin to think of electrons as waves, but it wasn't really motivated except for Bohr wanted quantization in the end. Why? Because he wants to explain the frequencies that are emitted as the difference in energies between the allowed orbits. As the electron moves from one orbit to another, it emits a particle that has exactly that energy. And that particle carries an energy that corresponds to the frequencies that you see, because E equals H nu. So that's how you get the discrete frequencies, and that's what Bohr was after. To have the discrete colors emitted, he needed an atom that had fixed discrete orbits, and he injected that quantization in sort of ad hoc. But it worked. So momentum times radius is N times H bar. This is the same as angular momentum, if you remember way back when. So he quantizes angular momentum is the way that Bohr might have said it. So if I take this and I solve for V, I get V in terms of this N is H bar and the M and the R. And I'm going to take this V and I substitute it in to this equation for that. Okay? So when I do a little bit of algebra. So I just take that new V and I substitute it in this equation that I just showed you, and you get this. And now I solve for the radius. Not any radius is allowed, only particular radii are allowed. And the ones that are allowed correspond to the allowed n's here. N equal 1, n equal 2, n equal 3. When we look at the hydrogen atom, or if you go back and you look at what you already know from chemistry, this turns out to be the S orbital radii we'll talk about. So these are the allowed radii for the atom, and if I have if I have a Z for the nucleus, I have Z protons, then I get a Z down here. But here's the equation that describes where the radii are. If I say, let's look at the ground state, so the ground state of hydrogen, I would set Z equal to 1, and I would put N equal to 1, and I can calculate with the rest of the constants what I get. If I look at how the radius, if I take the R equal 1, which would be what you get if it set Z equal 1 and N equal 1, so it's H bar squared over K E squared M, that's just a constant, you can calculate what it is. We're just going to call it R1 here. The things that really vary as you go from orbital to orbital, or from orbit to orbit, is this N squared and the Z if you have Z protons. So there's a very particular description of where the electron can exist in this Bohr atom. If I have quantized its velocity and its radius, I mean, I can now calculate the allowed energies, basically. So I can calculate, remember I quantized velocity, I pop that in here, and I can get the kinetic energy. I can substitute in for the R, which we just calculated, and when I do this, it gets a bit more complicated, but I get a very simple expression in a sense. These are all constants. Mass of the electron, K you know, Z is depends on the atom. The electrons, this is H bar, these are just constants. N is just a number. So what it says is that the electron exists at discrete radii and it has discrete energies, energy levels, which I can then calculate. There is a potential energy you have to take into account. See how much of this I want to actually get into. In the end, if you look at the total energy of the electron in each orbital, you have this expression. I'm going to put all this on the web so you can go through the algebra to convince yourself. But what you find is that if you look at the energy of the ground state, we'll call it E1, the energy of each successive level that depends on this integer N, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, goes as Z squared over N squared. So Bohr has this simple, we call it a semi-classical model because classical in that the particles are point-like, they move in classical circles. Okay? Semi-classical in that he says these circles are stable and he injects this quantization condition ad hoc. Okay? None of that is classical, but it's not really well-motivated either, so it's not really quantum mechanics. It's this weird sort of hybrid state. He then says how this connects to spectra is that if a particle goes from a higher energy state to a lower energy state, it emits a particle of light whose energy corresponds exactly to this difference in the energy between those two states. E equals H nu. Once I know what E is here, that tells me what color it is. So if I have discrete energies that are predicted, because these are fixed for a given atom, so it tells me I'll have a spectral line from here, a spectral line from here, and a spectral line from here. I'll have three different colors emitted by this atom that has three energy levels, for example. I can take gases of atoms, and I can put a continuous white light behind it, and it turns out that those atoms will absorb light at exactly those frequencies that you saw them emitting light from. That was the emission spectra. If I absorb it, it's called the absorption spectrum. And absorption corresponds to the atom being excited from a lower energy state up to a higher energy state. That's old hat to you, but this was pretty new stuff back in 1912. And it works pretty well. It turns out that you take the Bohr model and you look at the hydrogen atom spectra and you get pretty close to what you see. And that is a pretty cool clue that you're beginning to have a sense of how matter actually works.
Life is more complicated if I add another electron in, so multi-electron atoms are tough. As odd as it may seem, as many brilliant people have been out there in the world, nobody's actually figured out how to exactly solve a three-body problem. So if you're going to do three bodies, that is add the second electron, you have to do basically iterative work. And it's easily done on a computer. You can make it as accurate as you want. So it's not that we don't know answers, but it turns out that it's hard to do. But the hydrogen atom is the thing. You've got to get the hydrogen atom right. And if you do, then you can begin to think that you're starting to understand the essence of matter. So Bohr made tremendous progress. And in fact, he predicted spectra, which are pretty much what you see. Okay, so I guess I've already talked a little bit about this. What we just saw was a emission line spectrum of an atom, so hot gas, and you spectrum analyze it. If you take a cold gas and you have a white light behind it, then you'll see the same thing, but you'll have absorption lines where you had emission lines earlier. You may think, why do I care? If you want to understand what are the atoms that exist in stars, for example, you would be looking at absorption spectra often. If you have cool gas around the star absorbing the light coming from below. So there's... You can use this atomic fingerprinting to figure out what atoms are where. So, while we're at it and we have the tools to talk about it for a moment, we can talk for a moment about X-rays, because those are near and dear to many of your hearts. The way you classically make X-rays is you have a big potential difference between two plates, basically, and you get a beam of electrons that are accelerated through a large potential difference. If those electrons have enough energy, they'll actually, when they collide with an atom, they may knock an electron out of the core of an atom, out of one of the inner shells of an atom. If you take just the Bohr model, and you go to, let's imagine that you calculate, I have a big nucleus here full of lots of positive charges. And you can calculate in the Bohr model, ignoring all the other electrons for a moment, what the energy and radius of this inner orbital should be. Turns out it's not a crazy approximation because all these other electrons are further out, so they don't really screen the charge. Those inner electrons sort of see the charge of the inner nucleus. If I knock out one of these electrons, then some other electron along here is going to drop down into that to make a lower energy atom. When it does, if you calculate the energy difference between these orbital levels, it's huge if you have a big Z down here. So when you knock out an N equal 1 electron and one of these other electrons drops back down, the photon energy is very high, high frequency, of X-rays. And in fact, those X-rays will come out in discrete lines. These would be known as the K-series X-rays from some heavy atom. The energy for the X-rays ranges from about 100 to 100,000 electron volts. You can think of that as being the kind of energy you have to have across these two plates to produce them. But that's the essence of how you get... You don't just get strict spectral lines, because you'll also have electrons basically with arbitrary energies not so much bound in the atom that will come in. And so that will come in with sort of a continuous spectrum. So you'll get a discrete line and then sort of on top of a big continuous spectrum of X-rays. If I remove the N equal 2 electron, then I get discrete pattern, and these are called the L-series X-rays. You okay with that? X-rays? Okay. I mean, this is how they do it at the dentist.
You ever notice they'll put the big lead thing on you so you don't have two-headed babies, and then they'll back away, and they'll, you remember those. Okay, all they're doing is they're putting the, you know, big potential difference and actually letting some blast of x-rays go. All right, so next step.
If you believe that particles can be waves, then Bohr's model, although it sort of works, which means it contains elements that are clearly important,
but it's sort of crap too, because it does not treat the electron as a wave. If you say the electron is a wave, then you need to solve a different problem. And our classical picture of a particle going around in a circle doesn't make any sense if that particle's a wave. It doesn't work. So, in the 1920s, some really smart people had to invent wholly fresh a new mechanics where it was a mechanics for the physics of waves with mass. And that's what we formally know as quantum mechanics now. Okay? And it took some time to do it. These two guys sort of get the bulk of the credit. There were a number of other people involved. They came up sort of with independent solutions to show it. If you're into matrices, this guy had a kind of sort of based on matrices. The mathematics was not real intuitive. This guy's mathematics was more intuitive, and this is what most of us have learned, will learn about when we're trying to learn quantum mechanics. I am not going to even attempt to motivate where the equation comes from. Basically, the idea was we have to come up with a mechanics that works for waves. And life is really different, and I will talk about some of the differences. But this is the equation that they came up with. You got a problem. If you want to describe the location of an electron, if it's a particle in Bohr's theory, it's easy. The electron's here, it's here, it's here, it's here, it's in this circle, and you know where it is. That's there. But if the electron's a wave, what the hell do I even mean when I talk about its position? You're at the beach. There's a wave. At some level, I can say where that wave is. But try to get precise with that. Okay, where exactly is that wave? What do you really even mean when you talk about the exact location of that wave? How do you define that? So life becomes very bizarre when you talk about waves. So in fact, in this equation, you end up having to describe, in a sense, the location or other properties through something called the wave function, psi, which depends on your coordinate system, whatever it is, and this is a one-dimensional thing. It's got second-order spatial derivative. And in this one, this is the time-independent equation. This is the potential. So that is, I have my wave, and there's a certain force on it. And I describe that by this. So if I wanted to describe a hydrogen atom, I would put a spherical Coulomb potential right there. If I have some other system, I'll put a different potential here. And then I can calculate certain things with it, within certain limitations. So, if we take that equation and we put the spherical Coulomb potential in it, then you get all those atomic orbitals and things that you're used to doing in chemistry. Exactly. That's where it comes from. I may drag you through bits of that, okay? But what I want to do first is to show you something that's more doable. Because the hydrogen atom, the simplest system, is exactly soluble
But the mathematics is sort of nasty because it's spherical. So you've seen it, actually. You've seen that you get these S orbitals that are spherically symmetric, but you also get things that are not spherically symmetric, the P orbitals, the D orbitals, etc. So you know how painful that is. That's what drives chemistry, right? If you take an organic, you know how important it is that you deal with P orbitals and D, you know. What happens, that the shapes and energies and all that, that is what drives chemistry. But it's complicated, and it avoids the simplifications that I've been using all semester, which is we're not going to have angular dependence. And there's a reason. It's doable, but the math starts to get nasty. I'll probably drag you through some of the implications of it, much you've seen in chemistry, but I want to sort of show you where it comes from, partly so you can have some confidence in all this underlying stuff that you have to learn all about, but they don't really motivate too well typically in chemistry. So let's do something simpler. Let's go to one dimension, and let's have about the simplest force you can imagine, which is, we'll call it the square well potential. So in the square well potential, what we're going to say is if the electron, or whatever you want to think of it, the particle, exists in a region between zero and a place L on the x-axis, we will say there is no force on it at all. It is completely free. However, at L and at zero, we say there's an infinite potential. Think of it as a wall. That is, the particle simply is unable to penetrate at all past L or past zero. Okay? So that's the potential. We call it the square well potential. So how do I do that? Well, we take Schrodinger's equation, and all I've done is pull the H and the 2M over onto the right-hand side. And we define the U, which was in that equation, as zero, where we can solve for something. So it's zero. But it's infinite, less than zero or L. Okay, so that means the particle can exist here, but nowhere out here and nowhere out here. And I am out of time, so we will do the square well Thursday. Thank you.